This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Hartford Police Chief David Rosato had been scheduled to appear today on Where We Live. His office canceled on Wednesday, but we're trying to get him back on the calendar soon. We'll keep you posted. Meanwhile, we've planned an interesting show for you as we ponder the future of the automobile. Remember when Toyota Prius came onto the market? There was speculation the hybrid would lead to the end of gasoline and diesel-fueled cars. Now, fast forward to 2018, and while some car makers have created some models for consumers, there aren't that many electric vehicles available. Will they ever be mainstream? Just ahead, we'll ask that question and more to the executive director of the Energy Policy Institute at the University of Chicago. Also, how do you feel about driverless cars? Would you take a ride in one or maybe a driverless bus? Several cities in Connecticut have applied to a pilot program to prepare for this era. We'll hear more from a member of the state's Autonomous Vehicle Task Force. But first, do you take an Uber or Lyft on a regular basis? You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. You can email us where we live at WMPR.org. As always, find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. The ride-sharing companies have exploded worldwide, but there are consequences to their popularity, including congestion. For more, we're joined by Laura Bliss, staff writer at City Lab. She covers transportation, infrastructure, and the environment. She's joining us today from NPR's New York City studios. Laura, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Lucy.
I understand, I think it was last week, the New York City Council put a cap on the number of Ubers and Lyft. Tell us about the reasoning behind that.
That's right. And that was actually signed into law by Mayor Bill de Blasio this week. So it is officially in place. So this is something that's been kind of something that's been growing. There's been growing momentum behind a cap of this kind, right? So New York City Council has decided to put a one-year moratorium, basically, on the number of new Uber, Lyft, and other ride-hailing services that can be, or vehicles for these services that can be licensed. So they're saying no more for this 1 year while we study what's going on the roads. Because one thing that's been really challenging about this industry is that we don't have a lot of data on how many vehicles are out there. Well, we know that much in New York City, but we don't know a ton about how much they're adding to congestion, how much they're drawing folks off of public transit, and exactly where they're going. New York City has more data than other cities, but there's still a lot of questions to ask. And right now, New York City is grappling with, you know, higher and higher levels of congestion. It has carbon emission reduction goals, and it has a public transit system in crisis. So I think this cap, which is kind of half of what was proposed or actually is going into effect now, is an attempt to kind of get arms around the problem.
Now, how much of this, if at all, is related to how the taxi industry has felt about these ride-sharing companies, you know, taking business away from them? We hear anecdotal stories about some taxi cab drivers that aren't able to make any money.
That's right. So that's kind of the other half of what went on in New York City with the ride-hailing industry in the last couple of weeks. So there's this cap, and there's also part of this new law is the Taxi and Limousine Commission is going to figure out how to set actually a wage standard for TNC drivers, Uber and Lyft drivers. And that is absolutely fueled by these pretty grim economic prospects faced by yellow cab drivers, in part, right? So there's been, as we know, the kind of devastation of this industry by the introduction of ride-hailing services, right? Yellow cabs are highly regulated in New York City. There's this taxi medallion system that's been in place for a long time. And while, you know, owning a taxi medallion was once something of very high value, it's no longer now that you have this industry that's been so far pretty much unregulated coming in and kind of pouring new vehicles onto the road. So an attempt to put a cap on some of those new vehicles is a way to kind of even the playing field somewhat. And also, right, a minimum wage for Uber and Lyft drivers, on the other hand, right, is also a good thing because, you know, while we hear a lot about how devastating this has been to yellow cab drivers, Uber and Lyft drivers are not rolling in cash either. Right. I mean, I think about there's a survey recently done that showed about 60% of drivers for these services make less than $50,000 annually, and about a quarter make less than $30,000 annually. And again, on the yellow cab side, I think this has been really driven home in New York City recently. There's been 6 suicides by yellow cab drivers in the last 6 months. And all of those are stories tied to these kind of dire economic situations that these workers are facing.
You mentioned the people who are driving the Uber and Lyft cars that people are hailing using these apps. But when we look at the caps, we can understand if Uber and Lyft aren't happy with the cap being placed in New York City. But can you talk more about how that cap, who exactly that cap is hurting in terms of when we look at affordability, when we look at connectivity between different parts of the city, and even how Lyft impacts communities of color?
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't think we know yet how the cap is going to play out in all these terms, right? I think there's a lot that could happen. Certainly, Uber and Lyft are not fans of the cap, right? They would rather keep growing and continuing to grow the market, increasing the number of vehicles on the roads. And yeah, their argument is that, you know, with a cap, it's going to be harder to extend service to outer borough neighborhoods in New York City, which tend to be lower-income communities, communities of color. And it's true, you know, there has been this sort of growing body of research that's showing all kinds of things about Uber and Lyft and other services. And one of them, on the plus side, is that these services are reaching neighborhoods that were previously underserved by the yellow cab industry for a variety of reasons. So that's been a really great thing, I think, in the sort of larger transportation picture. Now, does putting a cap on the number of vehicles, you know, that are already out there necessarily mean that has to happen? I don't think we know that. That's certainly what the companies are saying. And you know, it's possible that that could be kind of a adverse political repercussion of this cap, right? But, you know, it kind of remains to be seen how the Taxi Limousine Commission here in New York City is going to respond to this new law. There's still a lot of details to be figured out, and I think the devil will kind of be in those details in terms of how the city works with these companies to make sure there's still equitable access.
This is Where We Live. Joining us from NPR's studios in New York City is Laura Bliss, staff writer at CityLab. She covers transportation infrastructure and the environment. As we look at how transportation is changing in our cities and towns, coming up, we're going to talk more about driverless cars and whether electric vehicles are going to become more and more mainstream. Those conversations coming up in the hour. Laura, I wanted to ask you, because you cover transportation, what does research say about Uber and Lyft and how much they are putting more cars on the road when you think about people that are, you know, sharing rides? Can you talk a little bit more about the time spent when there's no passenger in the car?
Absolutely. Yeah. to just kind of keep the focus here in New York City, because that's where all this kind of action has been the last week or so. And it is also where kind of the best data is, as I was saying. These companies are pretty hard to regulate because they're fiercely proprietary, which makes sense, but it's hard to know in a lot of places just how many miles they're adding to the road. But here in New York City, there's one researcher in particular named Bruce Schaller, who's been pretty hard on the trail of figuring out the impact. And his latest study looks at total miles of ride-hailing services over the last 5 years, I guess. So between 2013 and 2017, his latest numbers show that those services, Uber, Lyft, Via, Get, a couple other, added almost 1 billion miles to the road in the city. So that's a lot. That's not just, you know, that's not entirely new miles, right? Some of those trips, you know, might have come from, and we know probably did come from folks who would have otherwise taken a cab. Some of those miles might have come from folks who would have otherwise driven themselves, right? So those are kind of the same miles. We also know that about 50%, this is based on another city, about 50%, based on the New York City Department of Transportation's surveys, of those rides are coming off of public transit. So that means that's new miles on the road, right? If we can kind of rely on those numbers, right, which are still, you know, we want more of them, which I think is part of the motivation behind this cap. But if that's where the evidence is pointing, then we know that those are new miles on the road. And as you pointed out, deadheading, which is kind of the industry term, right, for taxis and for-hire vehicles that are on the road without passengers in them, they're traveling between trips, right, or they're waiting for a new trip, is also a huge portion, right? So we're thinking about new miles on the road. Well, you know, that's great. There's more people getting around, and that's a good thing, right? We want to increase mobility. But Schaller's research has actually found that about 50% of the new miles in New York City were attributable to deadheading in that time. Mm. And for comparison's sake, it's about 20% in San Francisco. That's like the best number we have. So again, you know, we need more data, but that what data we do have is kind of pointing to this kind of sense that we need to get our arms around the issue if we want to ease congestion.
At the same time, Lyft has promised to be carbon neutral. They present themselves as the green choice. You've written that they could be doing more. Can you explain more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So part of the reason that, so just to back up a little bit, Lyft did pledge to make all of its rides carbon neutral back in April. So all rides going forward, they're going to essentially buy carbon offsets, right, through various projects around the world, which is great, right? I mean, I think that's really laudable for any company. But I think it does kind of come back to that deadheading question, right? Those carbon offsets, right, are only going to be linked to the miles on the road that drivers are ferrying passengers in. And that makes sense, right? I mean, Lyft doesn't really know necessarily mm-hmm. what drivers are doing all the time, you know, when they're not carrying passengers in their backseat. So they're not necessarily going to put the carbon offset towards those miles. Mm-hmm. But if those miles make up like 50% of all, you know, the miles they're adding to the road and all those carbon emissions and all the idling and traffic, that's still a problem.
Coming up, as I mentioned, we're going to talk more about autonomous vehicles. We hear and we've read that a lot of these companies are planning on a future of driverless Ubers and Lyfts. So can you talk more in your research, you know, how would a model of a city full of these self-driving Ubers change what we're seeing on the roads today?
Yeah. It's a great and really fun question to think about. And it's certainly true. Uber and Lyft both have teams of people devoted to this very question. I mean, Uber in particular has obviously been very visible in its testing of its autonomous vehicle technology. They're definitely both planning on this, right? And you can kind of see how ride hailing from the passenger side of things, right? You open your phone, you press a button, a car shows up, you get in the back seat. I mean, sometimes you're talking to the driver, sometimes you're not. It's kind of almost like it's already an autonomous vehicle. So their business model, right, kind of lines up with this imagined future where that's it, right? Autonomous vehicles are what we're relying on. And, you know, in Uber and Lyft's case, the model is shared autonomous vehicles, right? That we're not necessarily all going to need to own our own, but that we can share them. So there are some exciting and promising things about, you know, the future of autonomous vehicles, or so we're kind of told by the industry largely. You know, I think on the congestion and pollution front, right, I think that there is definitely a kind of consensus in the industry that these cars should be electric, you know, if we're pushing ahead in this direction. There's also this idea that, you know, if the cars are programmable, they can kind of talk to each other, they can travel in fleets, that could maybe reduce the amount of like stop and go traffic on the road. So maybe that's a good thing. On the other hand, right, you know, this is still likely years and years and years into the future by the time, you know, there's like enough, the technology is good enough, but, you know, the biggest cost for any transportation service, right, is labor. And so if we kind of remove that from the question for services like Uber and Lyft, that means the rides could get even cheaper, which is great for passengers, but that could also increase demand, right? That could mean we're going to want to take even more of these super convenient, super cheap trips. And you can debate, you know, is it a bad thing that we're going to travel more potentially? You know, you might have different feelings about that, but that is pointing, you know, in the eyes of a lot of researchers to a likely outcome of yet more congestion.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Laura Bliss is with us today from NPR Studios in New York City. She's staff writer at CityLab, covering transportation, infrastructure, and the environment. Now, driverless cars will become more common in the years ahead, and cities like Stamford, Connecticut want to be prepared for that change. Coming up, we're going to hear about a state task force looking at the future of autonomous vehicles. And you can join the conversation, too. Do you look forward to the day vehicles have no drivers, solely rely on artificial intelligence to get you where you need to go? Or are you worried about the consequences, like Laura mentioned, possibly more congestion on our roadways? Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We've been talking about how technology is changing our relationship with vehicles and how we think about transportation in the future. With us from NPR Studios in New York City is Laura Bliss. Again, she's a staff writer at CityLab covering transportation, infrastructure, and the environment. You can join our conversation, too. The number 860-275-7266. And you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Now, here in Connecticut, there's a group of state residents, lawmakers, and other officials studying the future of driverless cars here in our state. For more about the Autonomous Vehicle Task Force, Jackie Lightfield is joining me in studio. She's a member, again, of that task force and executive director of the Stamford Partnership. Jackie, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
So some of our listeners might be surprised to hear there's an Autonomous Vehicle Task Force. Tell us about when and why it was created.
So the impetus behind it was to try and position Connecticut not as a follower, but a leader in adopting the best practices that are going on in some of the rapid changes that are happening from the autonomous vehicle technology. And we needed to be able to take a look at what laws need to change to allow these to happen, and certainly looking at some of the incidents that have happened in other states as they've allowed things. Like in the state of Arizona, where they basically said, yes, come here and do your stuff and we'll figure stuff out, to the more regulated environments like California, where they put limits or allowed specific types of vehicles to be tested on the roads.
So tell us more about how Stamford specifically is looking to, you know, explain the pilot program and why Stamford's kind of trying to lead the way in a sense.
So Stamford has always been a leader in technology and innovation for the state, and we've been working in conjunction with the state in creating an innovation district where we wanted to invite high-growth tech companies to locate and test their products and services in Stamford, autonomous vehicles being one of them. And we put together a pilot in partnership with UConn and the Connecticut Department of Transportation to investigate how we can test autonomous technology, whether it's vehicles themselves or the sensors that are used on the vehicles. Harman is headquartered in Stamford, and they do a lot of technology as it relates to in-vehicle sensors and deployment. And we wanted to basically be one of the cities that you can test this technology that's different from some of the other sites. So a lot of sites in the West are flat and sunny all the time. We're a four-season location. We're a suburban city, so we're very car-centric, but we're very proximate to New York City and in the Northeast Corridor between Boston and New York City, where we have access to the technology and talent and the researchers that are doing this work that they could test in our environment.
So you mentioned that the task force is fairly new. Talk a little bit more about, I guess, some of the regulations that you may be considering or how you would try to think about the safety concerns. We can get a little bit more from Laura about that Arizona example.
Sure.
I'm sure all of us have heard about different stories of these, you know, these autonomous vehicles having a backup driver and then things go wrong because of human error, maybe not paying attention. But I'm curious how you're going to weigh regulation, safety, and when you'll be putting forth these recommendations.
Sure. Well, the task force basically is serving as a way to evaluate the existing regulations and laws as it pertains to allowing vehicles on Connecticut roads, you know, just regardless of whether they're autonomous or not. And then identifying what other regulations are needed by taking a look at the other states and how they've implemented regulations and policies, and also working with the industry to understand where the major car manufacturers are headed in integrating some autonomous technologies. And as I like to point out, every time you drive by a billboard and you see "Don't text and drive," that is actually an advertisement for autonomous vehicles, since drivers have basically decided that they would like to do something else instead of actually paying attention on the road. There is a behavior model that is saying this autonomous stuff is probably going to make the roads a little bit safer. The task force itself is going to be looking at that regulatory environment, but also the safety issues as it's unrolling in other states. UConn is participating in the task force and has a automotive safety program that is heavily involved in looking at those particular issues. So we'll be collecting a lot of data and working with our industry partners to develop kind of like a guideline for the legislators to review as they start thinking about policy changes within the state. The other aspect of the task force is to take a look at which cities or towns within the state should be allowed to do a pilot. And that's measuring against what would be tested and what the outcome is hoping to achieve. In the case of Stamford, we're known for our rather congested yes. area around the transportation center and I-95. And we've been talking for many years about trying to solve that. It's our intent that we think we can solve it with some type of autonomous technology, and we want to experiment to see how that would actually play out.
Are you more of a proponent of seeing autonomous vehicles when we think about public transit versus we know that individuals like their privacy, they like their to be independent, they like to go when they want to, and they may not want to share that vehicle with others. So I mean, in terms of looking at the future, does it make more sense to have that ride sharing capability as part of the autonomous vehicle that is electric?
Well, I think that the overall view is kind of counterintuitive. I think autonomous technology gets us to more of a pedestrian-friendly area. It improves a lot of different issues that are affecting how we navigate within our cities and towns. The biggest one is that, you know, we in Connecticut, we've designed a system that hasn't really addressed the last mile. So we expect people to take their cars, drive to a train station, mm-hmm. hop on a train and get somewhere else, and then figure out how to get from the train station to their place of employment or the place that they're trying to visit. And we've done we haven't really done a lot of innovation in terms of addressing what better ways that we can do this. And so the autonomous technology is more than just the idea of the driverless car. That's the sexy part. Everybody mm-hmm. understands what we talk about when we're talking about that. But it's really the logistics of traffic management, monitoring congestion, and kind of reducing the issues of air quality around highly congested areas. And there's different ways of solving for those different cases. So in the idea of mass transit, yes, it makes a lot of sense to kind of, you know, get a group of people to a similar destination or the same destination as efficiently as possible. But whether they want to do that or not is going to be the big question. So I think in how we've designed our pilot in Stamford was to basically approach it with, we think this is going to happen if we do this, and let's see if people react to it, or does the logistics and software actually work to make that happen.
This is Where We Live. You're hearing Jackie Lightfield. She's executive director of the Stamford Partnership, one of the cities that's part of a pilot looking at the future of driverless cars and changing our transportation infrastructure. Also a member of Connecticut's Autonomous Vehicle Task Force. You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Michael's calling from Meriden. Michael, go ahead with your question.
Hi, thanks for having me. I have a question about how autonomous vehicles are going to affect the insurance industry. Tesla, is working on autonomous 18-wheeler trucks for shipping needs and freight and whatnot. And I want to know how that's going to affect the insurance industry.
Good question, Michael. This, again, probably one of the questions the task force is thinking about.
Oh, yes. There's lots of industry interest in it. And I think that the answer kind of lies on a national scale. The insurance industry is working very closely with vehicle manufacturers because they certainly understand that the liability issues extend to the components of the vehicles. So before we even get into the how do we deal with an insurance of a vehicle that is driverless, the research that's being done at the industry level between car manufacturers or vehicle manufacturers and the insurance industry itself are working through those issues more at a component level. And we see that kind of in how the transportation network companies like Uber and Lyft are dealing with insurance issues where people are using personal vehicles for commercial purposes, that they may or may not be employees of these companies. And I think on a state level, there are various challenges to whether the company's position that they're not employees versus the state saying, yes, they are because they are working for you, is going to get litigated out and resolved. And I think by the time that we see a personal and a passenger car that is driverless, those issues will have been resolved.
I want to bring back into the conversation Laura Bliss, staff writer at CityLab, who covers transportation infrastructure and the environment. Laura, could you talk a little bit about how different states are moving forward with certain task forces like Connecticut, examining these questions and trying to spur on innovation where they live?
Yeah, certainly. Connecticut is definitely not the only state convening these kinds of task forces. I think most major cities are looking at ways to start piloting these technologies, and certainly the most populous states are also looking at how to pass traffic safety laws around them and state level regulations. I think that there has been somewhat of a hush over the AV industry on the industry side in the last 6 months or so. I think in the wake of a fatal crash that occurred in Arizona with a Uber self-driving vehicle, where the driver struck and killed a pedestrian. And I think on the kind of state regulation side, right, that incident really did drive home this idea that there is a need for greater scrutiny and probably rulemaking. Arizona was a state that had really cultivated a kind of lawless environment for AV testing. And that was, a kind of economic, boon for them. It became this kind of AV industry hotbed with lots of testing occurring there. But I think we saw kind of the effect of that. So I think you do see some states taking a little bit more of a backseat in following something like that, and I think the companies too taking a little bit closer look at their testing practices.
Now, Laura, I think you or one of your colleagues at CityLab wrote a little further about after that fatal crash in Arizona about some of the challenges with making sure that these autonomous vehicles are safe when they become more common. And there's been an examination of what was called the handoff problem that was seen in the aviation industry when you factor in human error. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. Yeah. Right. So that was my story, looking at talking with a number of former and current backup drivers. Right. So these are the folks who are sitting in the, drivers and passenger seats of, Uber and Waymo, which is the Google self-driving car project, and several other companies. And with the Uber testing program, and this is changing, actually. They just started testing cars again in Pittsburgh very recently after that crash. But previously, there had been about a six-month period where they were only testing with one person. Just one person behind the wheel, kind of responsible for these very long shifts, letting the car kind of operate themselves, and yet, this human being sort of expected to keep their hands hovering above the wheel and kind of ready to intervene at any time, because of course this is still, pilot technology. It's not fully there yet. And what kind of happens in that situation is exactly what you said, Lucy, the handoff problem. When you have a technology that's working pretty well most of the time, it's human nature. Studies show it's human nature to get kind of lulled into a state of complacency and even boredom, right? If you're the only person in the car and you're not allowed to listen to music or look at your phone, obviously. And so we know that that was a factor in the crash in March, although investigations are still ongoing. We know that this driver was actually looking at a device in her lap while she was supposed to be looking at the road.
You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, Laura Bliss is with us, and Jackie Lightfield, a member of Connecticut's Autonomous Vehicle Task Force. Jackie, I wanted to read a comment we got from a listener in Guilford, Eric, who either called in or sent this to us. He said, from a tech standpoint, from someone who has worked in autonomy and is an engineer, we are many, many decades off from having level 5 autonomy. It's a pipe dream that's really far off. Can you respond to that? And then when we think about the cars on the roads today, again, like when we think about what's in the future and then how we have a task force like the one you're on planning about, like, how do we navigate this?
So first of all, he's absolutely right. Level 5 is a fully autonomous vehicle where a human does not have to intervene for any condition whatsoever. And from a technology standpoint, from the ability of our sensors and the processing of the sensors, whether they're on vehicle or up in the cloud, we're still a long ways away on that. However, we are currently driving with autonomous tech. We just don't talk about it. When we use Waze or whatever mapping device where we say, I want to go to WNPR today from Stanford to Hartford, and it goes ahead and maps out the shortest route and tells you what exit to get off of, that is the autonomous tech that we're currently using, that nobody's regulating, that data is being collected, that the big tech companies are using that to model out traffic scenarios, road conditions, and so on. And I think that's an important issue that while we focus on, you know, kind of like the Jetsons view where you just hop into something and it drives you off to where you want to go because it knows where you want to go, what we really need to be focusing on are kind of like the nuts and bolts of where the technology is currently and how it's going to be implemented and at the pace it's going to be implemented. Because certainly 10 years ago, if we were talking about our driverless future, we would not have been talking about the fact that we would be all driving with these devices that would know more about our traffic conditions than the traffic engineers and traffic planners for all the municipalities in Connecticut and all of the DOTs are able to monitor. There's a huge difference in the quality and quantity of data between a traffic camera that's overlooking I-95 and the real-time traffic information of 30,000 people traveling between two exits that Google and others currently are processing.
David's calling from Hartford. David, go ahead with your question or comment.
Hi, I'm calling to ask or suggest that the Connecticut Task Force be involved with the drafting committee that the Uniform Law Commission has going on drafting a uniform law on autonomous vehicles. The notion is to have a law that addresses many of these issues that's similar or the same across all state lines. Folks involved in that process are representatives from each state who are uniform law commissioners, but also advisors are people like you, the insurance companies, the police departments, the technology industry, the vehicle industry, and consumers. So it seems to me that Connecticut ought to have its oar in the water as this drafting committee is doing its work, creating a uniform law. It should have its work done. It'll probably take at least 2 years to finish its work. But I'm encouraging that Connecticut have somebody there at the table, either by telephone or in person, when they have their drafting committee meetings.
All right, David, thank you for your comment. Jackie, did you want to respond?
Sure. I'm not that familiar with what the Uniform Law Committee is investigating. I do know from an industry standpoint that the automotive industry and the tech companies are looking for uniform laws and regulations as it applies to the vehicles themselves. From an insurance standpoint, first, our task force has many lawyers representing various aspects of the insurance industry and insurance industry representatives as well. But my understanding of the insurance end of it is that every state has its own regulatory environment and its own issues. And a lot of the conversation about how do one state's insurance regulations apply to another state's have sort of been litigated or discussed or figured out when it comes to the transportation network companies who are crossing state lines under different regulatory frameworks. And one of the tasks of the task force is a subcommittee that is specifically going to look at what are the analogous situations that we currently know about that have nothing to do with whether it's autonomous or not, and will they apply in the case that it is autonomous technology driving things. And I think the best example for that is the data that is collected on the vehicle currently with human drivers. Who has access to it? How is it used in an accident report? How is it used from an insurance standpoint? Who owns the data at the end of the day, and who has access to it, and how is it stored? And I think those are very important issues, regardless of whether we're talking about autonomous vehicles or not.
Randall on Twitter writes, I don't think any of the advantages of autonomous services like cars outweigh the negative impact of potentially millions of people who can no longer find work. Laura Bliss, if I can go back to you, I know when we've done past automation shows, this question always comes up. Can we talk a little bit more about the impact on labor and as we look to the future, how that will impact the types of jobs available?
Yeah, absolutely. And before I respond to that, I would just like to add to the last question about, you know, state patchwork, like a patchwork of state laws on the insurance side of things and data collection side of things. The same kind of debate is being played out on the city level, right? So the AV industry is lobbying pretty much every major state legislature, to pass laws that basically preempt localities from passing their own regulations around autonomous vehicles. And I think going back to the Uber cap, right, I think that's a really good example of why actually you do want some local control over transportation regulations to some extent. And so I just like to point that out too. You know, the industry sort of saying, we don't want a patchwork. On the other hand, cities are like, you know, we're going to need to get our arms around, you know, safety and traffic issues that are ultimately quite local. So there's that. Yeah, on the labor side, I think you know, automation and labor, it's this sort of there are problems related to automation taking over, you know, jobs in virtually every sector of our economy, right? And transportation is absolutely one of them, as it is. And I think we do see a kind of coming, you know, more writing on the wall for, you know, taxi drivers and truck drivers, obviously, pretty much across the different transportation sectors. I can say that in public transportation, you know, that is sort of an area where I think most people are saying we're going to need people in the car, or in the vehicle, rather, kind of managing the very human, you know, issues that come up when you're navigating a vehicle full of people. And I think, like, on the you know, ride-hailing side of things, we don't really know yet, right? Like, what happens when you have just a bunch of people in a car with no kind of mediating presence, right, that the driver sort of provides currently. So I don't think we totally know. But I think there's definitely a reason for concern among people who are currently employed in that sector.
Laura Bliss, again, staff writer at CityLab. We'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us, Laura.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Jackie Lightfield, Executive Director of the Stanford Partnership, member of Connecticut's Autonomous Vehicle Task Force. Jackie, we hope to have you come back to talk more about the work the task force is doing.
Sure, I'd love to. Thank you.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Now, it's safe to say self-driving cars won't make up a majority of vehicles on the road anytime soon. But what's the latest on electric vehicles and the intended goal of reducing emissions and our over-reliance on fossil fuels? Coming up, we're going to talk more with the Executive Director of the Energy Policy Institute at the University of Chicago. Do you drive an electric vehicle or want to? Is the sticker price preventing you from buying one? Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Will electric vehicles ever become mainstream? For more on that, and we want to welcome to our show Sam Ory, Executive Director of the Energy Policy Institute at the University of Chicago. He's joining us by phone. Sam, welcome to Where We Live.
Thanks for having me.
When we think about electric vehicles, we think about Tesla, for one. It's very niche. But when I ask the question about electric vehicles becoming more mainstream, are we seeing that happening in other countries?
We definitely are seeing it happen, or begin to happen, I should say, in other countries. I think, you know, oftentimes when we talk about the electric vehicle market, people get a little too focused, I think, on just the U.S. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think some of the most interesting developments in the EV market are really in China. If you look over the first half of this year, for example, at the largest manufacturers of electric vehicles globally, you know, Tesla is up there. It's number two. But BYD and BAIC, both Chinese companies, are in the top three as well, BYD being the largest manufacturer in the world for the first half of this year. You know, so just to put those numbers in a little bit of perspective, you know, so BYD in the first half of this year produced a little more than 70,000 electric vehicles for sale in China. So, you know, it's a real business. It's growing, but at the same time, you know, China is also experiencing a huge boom in sales of gasoline powered SUVs. Just last year, for example, the Chinese SUV market, you know, got to be about as big as the U.S. SUV market, and that's about, you know, 10 million around that order of magnitude per year. So, you know, the EV industry is growing, but, you know, if you put it in a little bit of perspective and compare it to some of the other technologies that are on the road, it's still, you know, it's still got a lot of ways to go. It's, you know, these vehicles are somewhere between 1 and 5% of the market in most places.
When we talk about expansion, what's driving that? When we think about Tesla, obviously those are expensive cars. I'm wondering if battery costs are going down. What's making people turn to these vehicles more?
Certainly battery costs are coming down, since you mentioned it. You know, when the industry was really starting to, you know, get going in the 2008-2009 time period, the batteries that power most of these vehicles today, lithium-ion batteries, were, you know, the price was in the range of $1,000 a kilowatt hour or more. And, you know, most estimates of those costs are now that they're, you know, they're much closer to $250 or $300 a kilowatt hour. So the costs have come down quite a bit. But, you know, I don't think that in most markets, certainly not in the United States, generally speaking, people are not buying these vehicles yet today based on the economics. They're not buying them because they want to save money or because they're going to save money. I think for the most part, in the U.S. anyway, the real driver is, you know, the technology. Tesla is an expensive car, but it's a very cool technology. And if you look at the segments of the market, you know, where Tesla is competing, it's in the luxury end. And that was a very purposeful strategy by Tesla to be able to sell into the luxury end where people were less cost sensitive and be able to, you know, learn a lot about their technology and drive down costs over time. Now, if you look at Europe and China, you know, the economics are better. The fuel prices are obviously higher. And so, you know, I think most estimates that I've seen suggest that by the middle of the, you know, 2020s, or early 2020s in Europe and in China, that, you know, you'll be able to buy an electric vehicle for a comparable price as a gasoline-powered vehicle.
When we look at traditional gasoline vehicles, people still see them as a better financial deal, especially with the gas prices where they are now?
You know, you can look at gas prices, but, you know, just the technology costs are still high enough that that it would take you, you know, it would take you more than a reasonable time period to pay that down in the United States anyway. If you're looking in other markets where fuel prices are higher, you know, that's a slightly different calculation. But in the U.S., you know, we can look at gas prices now in the, with oil prices in the $70 a barrel range. And sure, they're higher than they were a couple of years ago, but they're still not by any means, you know, high enough that it would make the economics of an electric vehicle a slam dunk at this point.
And when we also look at the geography of the United States in terms of on the western side, too, when people are buying and using electric vehicles, you know, concerns about where they charge these cars, does that play a part in people's decisions?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's one of what I would just put into a bucket of kind of like, you know, consumer issues, mm-hmm. consumer user interface type issues. And it's a new technology, and there is, I think, some apprehension about, well, you know, I want to get one of these cars. Where am I going to charge it? And, you know, I think the good news is that As an electric vehicle driver myself, I can support a lot of the research that's out there that suggests that, you know, public charging is actually probably not that important. If you're buying a vehicle that's the right vehicle for you, charging at home and at the workplace is really accounts for the overwhelming majority of most people's charging needs. I do think we as consumers, as drivers, are used to this model where, you know, the refueling happens in public, and, you know, you go to the gas station at some point during your busy day, and that's how you handle refueling your vehicle. But, the logistics of refueling an electric vehicle are actually simpler in the sense that, you know, you just come home and plug in if you can. Now, that obviously requires a few things. One is it requires a dedicated parking spot, which, you know, a lot of Americans have. More than half of Americans have access to a dedicated parking spot, or half of drivers. But, you know, that still leaves a gap in the market. It also requires you to have, you know, the right kind of wiring where you're parking. So, these are parts of the I think the adoption process of these vehicles that people are getting, that the market is having to get used to a whole new paradigm of refueling. And I think that it does create a little apprehension for adoption.
I'm curious, when we hear of the Trump administration and their proposal to roll back regulation on vehicle fuel efficiency, how will that play into whether we see an expansion with electric vehicles or not?
Well, I think that, you know, it could have some impact in the United States. The rules themselves, have in there a variety of incentives for electric vehicles. The good news is that a lot of those incentives were written into the rules for the period from 2017 through 2021. And so, you know, under the rules that are in place right now, electric vehicles are treated as zero emissions vehicles. So in other words, the emissions that come out of the tailpipe are the only ones that are counted, not any of the emissions that come from the power plant that's generating the electricity for the vehicle. So the vehicle itself is treated as a zero emissions vehicle, and the automakers get bonus credits for selling the vehicle. So in 2017, for example, Nissan selling a Leaf counts as zero emissions against their credit or against their cap, and it counts as two vehicles. And so what that allows them to do is to, you know, sell heavier vehicles and have this large offset from electric vehicles. It's I think for some automakers, particularly, you know, automakers that have large SUV and truck components of their fleet, EVs were and probably are right now an attractive part of their compliance strategy. Allowing them to sell more trucks that don't meet the standards by offsetting under compliance with over compliance from their light vehicles fleet and from electric vehicles in particular. Now, those credits, those bonus credits, were always going to go away after the 2021 model year. What was expected to stay in place was some treatment of electric vehicles as zero emissions vehicles. And I think, you know, to the extent that that goes away, you know, that will have some impact on EV adoption or, you know, electric vehicle manufacturing in the United States.
Sam, we're almost out of time. I just wanted to throw in there, I mean, unfortunately, we don't have a lot of time, but in terms of when we look at electric vehicles, are they really better for the environment? Because when you have to plug them in, you still have to rely on fossil fuels.
Yeah. Let me just one last point on the rules. The bigger issue is going to be California has these zero emissions vehicle mandates, which are applicable in California and in several other states around the country. The Trump administration is going after those. If those go away, it will have a much bigger impact in the U.S. In terms of whether the vehicles are better for the environment, you know, obviously it all depends on the power plant that's producing the electricity. The good news is that in the United States, in almost every state of the union, and there was a good analysis from the Union of Concerned Scientists a few months back that showed that electric vehicles today on almost every state grid in the United States is better than driving a gasoline-powered vehicle.
Sam Ory, again, is Executive Director of the Energy Policy Institute and the Becker Friedman Institute at the University of Chicago. We packed in a lot in just a little bit. I'd love to have you back sometime, Sam. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Today's show produced by Carmen Baskoff. Thanks to technical producer Kion Wolf and Lydia Brown. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Have a great weekend.